high school kid thinking about the world's problems, and eventually that problem would take his life.
Welcome back to Parallel Justice, the podcast that dives into the crimes and cases that have dominated the national headlines through exclusive interviews with the very attorneys who fought the cases. Some of the discussion you hear today may be controversial. However, we know that silence, especially on tough issues, only enables and encourages wrongdoers. It's our goal to bring these issues to light so that we may have meaningful discourse around them. The views expressed in this podcast are those of our guests, who are experts in these areas. Their opinions are invaluable, however, they do not necessarily reflect the views of the National Center for Victims of Crime. The topics we discuss may be disturbing, and they are intended for adult audiences only. Some of these topics may also be triggering, and we encourage you to practice good self-care and seek support. I'm Renee Williams, Executive Director of the National Center for Victims of Crime, and your guide through this conversation. Now, let's start the show. Welcome back to another episode of Parallel Justice. Today, we have a special treat. We are, for the first time in Parallel Justice history, together in person. I am joined by one of my favorite attorneys, even though I don't think I'm allowed to say that, Mike Haggard out of Florida. Mike, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. This is fun to be in person, especially at the conference this year in St. Louis. Michael Haggard, I'm the managing partner of the Haggard Law Firm in Coral Gables, Florida, and I've been representing crime victims really across the country for the last 20 years.
And today we are here to talk about a case that has just been all over the headlines, and it is the Parkland school shooting case. But before we get into the what happened and the theories of liability, I hate when this happens in these cases. We always focus on the perpetrator, and they really get the infamy that they were looking for. We splash their name and their picture all over the media, and we see that in the Parkland shooting. That is still going. So I want to start with the victims, and you represented three of the victims in Parkland. So let's talk about them. Can you talk about who they were?
Sure. I'll start with Joaquin Oliver. He was a young student there, just a fantastic kid who ironically, in maybe the worst way, predicted this in ways. He had wrote letters to Congress about the gun problem in the United States prior to this occurring. Just to look at those letters and the forethought of a young high school kid thinking about the world's problems, and eventually that problem would take his life. His parents have become incredible advocates across the country, really supporting other victims of mass shootings, which is amazing that I'm saying that. And Joaquin was just a special hero. Scott Beagle was the cross country coach at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. A phenomenal guy. Just every student loved him. I've been to some of their cross country meets, and it's really spiritual watching them run for Scott. He stood in his doorway of his classroom and took multiple bullets and saved upwards of 25 kids. Knew what he was doing. Just an absolute hero who saved lives. Lost his own life. His mom has done, Linda and her husband, Mike, have done an incredible job in New York State, passing a great gun protection issues that have really saved lives up there. And also part of the big movement in Washington, done a great job there. And then Stacy Wappel, who was a teacher there and still is, never missed a day. She was very fortunate that she wasn't injured more. She's the first one that will tell you that. And she never thought about leaving, never thought about leaving her students, had to be back there for her students who all went through this, all the survivors who went through that incredible trauma. And she's still there. Just an absolutely amazing woman and a hero as a teacher, but also with everything she went through. So couldn't be prouder to represent those three families.
Now, how does Stacy still go back? Is she still working through some trauma, or what has she said about that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, no question about it. I mean, you know, but I think her catharsis, her healing is being there for her students. I think she views it, if she left and went to another school, which she could do in a heartbeat, that she would be leaving them. And you know, what's amazing is we get many years past, you know, there's no more students here that were there that day. But there are teachers and there's staff, and there's an incredible unity there for what they went through. The enduring spirit of the school, but no question about it. I mean, every time she walks in there, but I think she's become empowered by the mission to mold these young lives and to hopefully the adults who can cure this epidemic in our country, because Lord knows the ones who've gone before them have failed.
Now let's talk about what happened that day, because I think it's important. This was more than just a school shooting. There were multiple failures even before the shooter showed up that day. So just to set the table, what happened that day? Who was the shooter? What were the warning signs we saw? How did this play out?
Well, like you said, you know, we don't like to mention the name of the shooter, but I think everybody knows, you know, it's Nicholas Cruz, who his criminal trial is still ongoing, almost completed. It's a penalty phase. So it's about the death penalty or not. A very troubled young kid. I mean, the signs were all there. The signs were there throughout middle school in the Broward County School Board system, where he had a number of very troubling issues with threats and violence and those types of things. He was actually kicked out of Marjory Stoneman Douglas. And so the warning signs were all there in terms of the school board. They knew about this. They had a file on him. And in particular, you know, that day, obviously he came on campus in the view of where a police officer should have been, where a security guard should have been. He should have been denied entry with his history and everything along those lines. So that's just focusing really on the school board's knowledge. You know, again, social media, where a number of these mass shooters tend to go to tell all of us what they're going to do. He was out there making threats, doing those types of things. He had been committed and been getting treatment at a certain facility for violence, for threats, for all these things going on. He was released from there. So all the warning signs were there. And we'll talk about it more, I'm sure. But there was a tip that went to the FBI, very specific, saying exactly what he was going to do. And that's where we talk about the failures of the FBI in this case, which is a little unique in these type cases.
Now, you mentioned he's gone through the liability portion of his criminal trial. Did he offer any defenses? What happened there?
Yeah, so they admitted fault. So there's no, in terms of guilt, that's determined. And then the defenses on the penalty side were everything from, you know, mental illness, you know, all the different things that you can think someone would raise to try to get someone life instead of death in this case. And you know, it all the families have been there. The victim impact statements, if folks listening, you know, have not listened to those, I strongly encourage that they do. We're going to get permission from our clients when the trial is over to really release some of those, because it shows people something that I think we've all talked about, which is very important, is what happens to the human body? What happens in a mass shooting with an automatic weapon such as an AR-15? It's awful to think about, but we all have to think about it if we ever want it to stop. And this penalty phase, I give so much credit to the prosecutors, because they're not just trying to convict him. They're trying to, rightfully so, convict our society for allowing this to happen time and time again and explaining what an AR-15 does to a 17-year-old. And we've obviously heard about even more horrific things of what it does to a 6 or 7-year-old and their smaller body. And America needs to wake up and listen to this.
How old was he when he committed this crime?
He was 18.
Did he obtain the firearms legally? The AR-17 assault rifle, did he obtain that legally?
Absolutely.
So a lot of civil lawsuits have come out of this case, and we've seen quite a bit of liability come out. Most recently, there was a settlement from the FBI. So I'd like to break each one of these out. What was the theory of liability against both the FBI and the Broward County Sheriff's Office?
Sure. So with the FBI, the FBI got a very, very specific tip that this shooter was going to shoot up his high school. And so, you know, people may at first blush say, well, wait a minute. I mean, the FBI gets a lot of tips. What do they do? But they can be liable when they have a specific tip on a specific shooter with a specific target, because now a protectional mode needs to go into play, that they've got to react to that. They did absolutely nothing. They didn't act on the tip in any way. They didn't warn the Broward County School Board. they didn't warn their partners in law enforcement with Broward Sheriff's Office or go investigate the tip. They did absolutely nothing.
And you mentioned this kid had a history. This young man had a history of violence and danger and being kicked out. So there was at least some background for them to, it wasn't like somebody called a tip on John Smith, who's never done anything, and it was a revenge tip.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, he had been in Henderson Behavioral. He had been in a mental health facility. Obviously, the school board and the particular junior middle school he went to and the high schools he went to had the files on him. I mean, and the Broward County School Board knew that. But you're right. I mean, once you get this tip, you call the school. Now, bells are whistling, fire alarms going off. Oh, my gosh. You shut down the school. You arrest him. And this never happens. And so, yeah, I mean, the FBI case, it was a unique. There was just one right before that that the FBI and the Department of Justice had settled. So this was on the heels of that. So we had that precedent going forward. And all the law firms worked together on that. And that was a $127 million result, which some people look at that number and you think about, well, you have 17 tragic deaths and 17 serious injuries, not to mention so many victims of trauma that and post-traumatic stress disorder that witnessed this and everything along those lines. So and hopefully as a society, you know, we need the FBI in this fight. We need alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. We need local law enforcement. Everybody's got to be working together because Lord knows our lawmakers aren't making it easy on any police department in the country or the FBI. So we need to learn from this case from all levels so that we can do better in protecting, all our society, but most of all our kids.
Now, we've briefly touched on this in this podcast before, but I think it really serves a point for clarification. In the FBI case, you were essentially suing the U.S. government, which means DOJ steps in and provides the attorneys, correct?
Absolutely.
So how is that process different than kind of a normal civil suit? And how is it different for families? How does it change the families?
Yeah, it really doesn't affect the families at all because it's just a different defense firm, if you will. It's just the Department of Justice. So people kind of forget the Department of Justice obviously has all the U.S. attorneys, the federal prosecutors, but they have a civil division handling all different types of cases, whether it be, God forbid, an Air Force crash or something like that. They're dealing aviation cases. Here, the DOJ assigned a number of lawyers defending the FBI in this type of failure to act on a tip case, which is a little bit unique, and everything along those. I mean, dealing with the government always is a little different, but I think they stepped up and did the right thing. And you know, our point with that is, where do we go from here? I mean, to me, really every case I handle, the number one priority is to get justice for the family. Mm-hmm. But right behind that is, how do we prevent this from happening again? I've sat across from enough devastated families in my career. I never want to do it again. We have an opportunities with violent crime to really prevent these from happening. And this is an area that, I think all the federal partners and people really have that interest. And I think the FBI really is, if we're going to stop active shooters and mass shootings, we have to have America's law enforcement division working with us. And that's the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So I'm proud of them for stepping up. They made a terrible mistake, as did many others, like you said, in this case. And now it's where we go from here to prevent the next one.
Well, let's talk about those others. There was also a suit against the Broward County Sheriff's Office, and they've received really widespread criticism in this case for their handling of the response. It seems like this is parallel to a very current case, which is Uvalde. What happened with Broward County? Are there parallels? And let's start with what happened.
Sure. I think there are absolute parallels to Uvalde and the Parkland situation. You know, Broward Sheriff's Office provides a police officer at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. His name was Officer Peterson. His job is to secure the school. He failed to detect Nicholas Cruz to come into the campus facility, to walk onto the property. And then immediately when he started shooting, he did nothing, never went in the building. Never did anything to support the effort to stop him at all.
What did he do?
He did nothing. I mean, there's really, and that case is ongoing. So the school board case is settled. The Broward Sheriff's Office case is separate trial and going to be tried. And I think it's really important because I think that, you know, when we talk about mass shootings in general, you know, certain people's natural reaction is, well, if you just give the good guy a gun, everything will stop. And we saw in Uvalde, that's not what happened. I mean, when you look at that hallway in Uvalde, you see a bunch of officers who I'm sure generally good officers do a good job. And they're thinking about someone who's got a AR-15 who's shooting at will. And they know that that person doesn't care if they die that day. They care less. The officers want to go home to their wife or their husband or their kids. And that's the problem we deal with mass shootings, is that the mass shooter is prepared. They know what they're going to do that day. They're wearing body armor, as we've seen almost in every one this year. And they've got better firepower than our law enforcement do in most situations.
And they don't care about rules of engagement.
Absolutely. And they don't care if they could care less about seeing the sunset that day. They don't care. So we have to know that going in and know giving the good guy with a gun does not work. Ask the heroic former police officer, security guard in Buffalo, who was at a supermarket and was incredibly out everything, and tried to do all he could, got off three or four shots and was killed. And that's not going to work. And if we're going to, in this country, allow the bad guys to have better weapons than we have, what are we doing? So that BSO case really parallels that, and a total failure on that police officer in the police department.
That leads to the interesting point, though. You've got one police officer at Majory Stoneman Douglas High School. You've got one cop who is meant to secure that whole building. So the option is we have one cop who we know isn't going to do anything, even if he can. How else do we secure our schools? Do we put 40 cops in a school? Do we want that type of environment for our children to be learning in? And I think that's something that lawmakers are going to have to grapple with.
Yeah, I mean, I will tell you this. I mean, number one, if Peterson had acted appropriately, when he got the, number one, sees him on campus, is communicating with the school, you know, this kid can't come back, and he sees him on campus, he was in the proper position. This never happens. If he sees Nicholas Cruz and acts appropriately, you know, I think that at that point he could thwart it. Secondly, the minute the shots were fired, if he calls for immediate SWAT team backup and they act appropriately, not Uvalde, but how they're trained, how BSO SWAT team is trained, that never happens. Now, the simplest thing to do as a society is take that weapon away from the bad guy. I mean, why? Like if I'm playing the, you know, back when the Patriots were really good with a guy named Tom Brady, I would rather have Tom Brady not playing the game. Why have their best weapon play? And that's kind of the point of how we have to, you know, security works. There's no question about it. But we can even help security more if we take the weapon away from the bad guy.
And what do you think of this idea? And I have thoughts on this. My whole family are school teachers. My mom, my dad, my sister, my brother-in-law, my aunt, my uncle, all school teachers. And there's this idea of let's arm the teachers. And I got to tell you, out of my whole family, my brother-in-law is the only one I would trust with a gun to not hurt himself more. So what do you think of the idea of let's just arm the teachers?
Well, I think it's insane for a number of reasons. You know, one reason is, I mean, I guess, you know, instead of having security at a hotel like we're in today, just arm the clerks. So they got to book you in the room. They've got to do this, got to answer the phone, and just have them have a gun too. I mean, if you want to have security, you have security do what? Security, not teach math, not teach English, but focus on security. I mean, it's such a cheap way to do things. You know, have a security guard deliver the towels here if somebody needs it. Have them replenish the shampoos. No, you have room service and you have security. So number one, it's just a flimsy way to not address the problem, not to mention the other problem. Teachers signed up to teach, make difference in lives, not sit there with a gun, ready if anything happens. And again, be outmanned because somebody's coming in with body armor and they're going to have a revolver and the bad guy's going to have an AR-15.
Well, and does that become part of their job application process? Can you shoot a gun?
Yeah. No, it's that part's insane. The other thing is when you hear lawmakers say, well, we'll just have all our retired military, all our vets be at every school. Well, I know a lot of vets. You know what they want to do after they retire? Rest. They want to do other things. Nobody said you had to serve in the U.S. Army or the Navy or the Air Force, and then you got to come back and protect our schools. We don't have enough of them to do that. It's just a flippant way of not dealing with the actual problem. Like when people talk about mental health, it's a huge problem. There's no question about it. How quickly are we going to fix our mental health problem in the United States of America? And by the way, everybody talks about it. You know what they do? They cut it.
Nothing.
They cut it.
They slap a Band-Aid because we love a good Band-Aid in America.
Absolutely.
We love a good Band-Aid in America.
We have a huge mental health problem. And there's no question that any of these mass shooters have to be mentally ill by definition, I would say.
I would hope a sane person wouldn't do this.
So are we going to do an MRI of every 330 million MRIs? Like, what's our mental health? You know, it's almost offensive when you think about the victims I've already talked to the audience about, to think that that's our response. Or that, you know, when you hear a Representative Gates say, oh, well, it's the borders are the problem, when we know the statistics say that's a joke. Saying that illegal immigrants, the 40,000 gun deaths in the United States, they're not by illegal immigrants. So let's deal with the real problem. If we're serious about it, which we're not. I mean, the sad thing is we're not.
We want to use rhetoric that sounds good and say we're protecting our children. Because then even if you put the vets at the front door, again, I go back to, is that the learning environment that we want our children to be going to? We've seen in Sandy Hook, there was a massive settlement against Remington, which was the maker of the gun in that case. There was recently announced a lawsuit in the Highland Park shooting case against Smith & Wesson. Is that possible in all of these cases now? Can we start going after gun manufacturers?
It all depends on the law in your state. So for instance, in Connecticut, there is a really well thought out statute dealing with deceptive trade practices. And so the theme in that case was that that Remington marketed that weapon to certain individuals, made it all about young males, get your masculinity back, you know, take control of your life, use this high powered weapon, all these different types of things. So the Unfair Deceptive Trade Practices Act applied directly to that. And for instance, in my state, you can't do that. We could not do that in Parkland because it is absolutely anti that. And I imagine most states are like that. I don't know the law in Chicago, but I would say a state that cares about it and looked at what happened in Connecticut. If you want to make a huge difference, the folks that make these guns got to be at the table and or off the table, meaning, you know, we need to bankrupt them. And they make weapons of mass destruction. Responsible gun owners aren't about those weapons. You know, I always talk about, when we talk about gun control, the best state in the union is Massachusetts. And Massachusetts gun control laws were passed by gun owners, NRA members, the Hunters Association, that said, one, background check me all you want. I'm good to go. Safe storage, I'll show you exactly where my gun's going. I'll take training. I'll do this. You cannot have an AR-15, and because you don't hunt with an AR-15. You know, you're not allowed on federal land, and really you can't hunt really anywhere. I mean, unless you only had your private ranch and you wanted, for some unknown reason, not be able to eat anything that you kill.
I was going to say, if you're hunting with it, you're not eating what you're hunting.
Yeah, no, unless you want to. I'd be really sick. But so in Massachusetts, and the results show, they had the lowest, you know, gun violence in the country. And you can have every bit of gun ownership. You can have the right to bear arms, with responsible gun laws. And responsible gun owners want that, because responsible gun owners aren't our problem.
Well, so I want to talk about that. So I fielded a very interesting question in the aftermath of Uvalde. And my answer was kind of a retired lawyer's answer of, no, that's a stupid question. But it wasn't. I just couldn't explain the why. Could there be a class action or any way to hold the NRA accountable? And I'm asking this now because you brought up responsible gun owners want good gun laws. or they're at least not opposed to them. Now, the NRA has opposed every single type of responsible gun law that you can think of. So is there a theory against the NRA, and why are they so against reasonable protections?
You know, I'll take the second part first, meaning why are they against? They're against it because their manufacturers run the NRA. So Remington, Brothers Arms, all these different manufacturers, I mean, that's where they make their money.
So NRA does not actually represent gun owners in the United States, people.
Yeah, not at all. Unless we think that because they're trying to protect something that they're really not protecting, because the vast number of guns that are bought are not these type weapons. So their interest and their money is from the manufacturers. I mean, that's who funds them. So they're not interested in that. And then secondly, with the class action, you know, an advocacy group, I think there's protections, obviously, you know, to sue an advocacy group for in a class action with the causation for what they advocate for, cause the instance. However, I think, again, when you're talking about being deceptive, doing certain things with the shadow money that they run and those things, I think there are a number of avenues. And I think what California just did recently is really instructive. They passed a law that will not go into effect till 2023, basically making the gun manufacturers liable for their weapons with a product liability theory, a strict liability theory. Now they're giving it time.
Now, can you explain? So we've got some lay listeners. So can you explain product liability and strict liability for me?
Sure. So you are a manufacturer, whether it be a car, whether it be,
a widget. We love widgets.
Yeah. And we can say a alcohol manufacturer. Think of cigarettes. I mean, that, I guess probably the best example is tobacco. And so California has said, gun violence is a huge problem. We know the problem. We know the problem that your weapons are creating. So we need to promulgate standards that if they're violated in any way, you'll be responsible for that weapon from strict liability, from it causing an injury. So, so now if you're selling it to gun shows that violate different things, you will be responsible. If there's red flag laws that are violated, if there's background checks that are violated, the manufacturer will be responsible. And so it makes the manufacturer finally participate in the discussion because they better. Because once you have a number of those Remington verdicts like we saw in Connecticut, now you have them in California, maybe you're having them in Chicago, how many of those, they're not the tobacco industry, make no mistake. When do they become bankrupt? Or when do they say, you know what, maybe it is a good idea that with guns we put fingerprint starting and we put codes and if God forbid something happens to me today, I fall in the Mississippi River, the police are going to have a tough time getting into my phone because I have a passcode. Apple won't give it to them. There's all these battles going over with serious criminal cases. You can't get into the phone. What if we did that with guns? Katie Porter, the representative from California, you know, asked if gun manufacturers would ever do that. And they said, absolutely no. But we do it with our telephones?
We require cars to have certain protections and drivers to have those protections. This is not an attack on gun owners. This would not hinder reasonable law-abiding gun owners in any way.
Absolutely.
At all.
Yeah. And when you look at the recent statistics, and for people in our country, 19 and under, forever, the number one cause, leading cause of death was car accidents. Now it's guns. That is a profound fact to me, because like you just said, what do we do about cars? Drivers have to have licenses. They have to have training. The cars have to have airbags, seatbelts. Now we have rear view cameras, beeping sounds, driverless, all these different things. But that's because car manufacturers wanted to get better. They wanted to become safer because of product liability laws and because just the right thing to do.
Just morals.
Gun manufacturers have no pressure on them. They're immune. You make somebody non-immune, they probably start making a better product. So it's good for everybody. So hopefully maybe we can get that done one day.
Let's talk about the aftermath and working with your clients through the aftermath and what's going on in the state of Florida. Now, the governor of Florida passed laws in response to this shooting. Can you talk about those and what they do, and in your mind, if they go far enough?
You know, I mean, they had the commission that looked at what happened, the failures of what happened and what happens at other schools. And, you know, it's kind of like what you said, Renee. I mean, how do you educate in that environment? I mean, at what point do you just make it a fortress and everything like that? The problem is you have to some extent. And so the commission came up with some good things for school security, more funding, those types of things. But that doesn't mean this is going to stop. I mean, I've made the comment several times. I feel terrible saying it. But if your child is going to school today in the United States of America, they're still at risk. They're at risk because we've done nothing about the gun problem. We've done nothing about the mental health problem in the United States. And we've done barely enough in the school security problem. I hate to say it, but campuses shouldn't be open. There has to be at every campus some point of entry that has some type of guard reference. You know, we don't, when you talk about these school shootings, you don't talk about a lot of situations where the security guard at the front of the police officer was shot and killed. You don't see that. Now, would it happen? Maybe it could. Does that alarm go off? Does the school get shut down? I mean, I've gone to conferences where they have one button that'll shut the whole school down with steel barriers. Is that where we're going? I don't know. I just, you know, what we do know is we haven't done anything to stop the criminal at all. And so we've left it all on the schools to do that. And Florida's done a little bit, but no, it's not enough.
How are the families that you helped dealing in the aftermath? What was it like walking them through each litigation piece, and how are they handling things now? Specifically, Joaquin's dad has made the news quite a bit. Manny, yeah. He's made the news quite a bit. So let's talk about how they're doing with the aftermath.
Yeah, I mean, I'm amazed at the strength and the courage of all my clients. I mean, handling catastrophic and wrongful death cases for as long as I had, you almost come in a weird way, like you get too close to it and it puts you in a weird place. And these families have done, they've done more, and I'm talking about all the Parkland families, not just my incredible clients, but they've done more to advance this cause than anyone, as has Sandy Hook, as has every one of these names that roll off our tongue too easily. Manny and Patricia, I mean, they are the word activist. I mean, my wife sometimes says, you might want to tell Manny. I'm like, there ain't no telling Manny.
And tell Manny anything.
You know, it's rare that I can say I kind of knew my client was going to get arrested at the White House. Knew that ahead of time. But
you were proud of him.
100%. And 100%. What I love about Manny is it doesn't matter red or blue. He does not care. It's about saving our kids and what Joaquin would do. And that's why they call their organization Change the Ref. And, equal with Linda Beagle. I mean, the amount of time she spends in the Capitol and meets with representatives and senators and tells Scott's story and his heroism and, you know, how proud she was of him. But why did it come to that? And I'm just amazed by their courage. I don't know how they keep doing it. I don't know how they keep going. Part of me always worries. They run out of gas. What do you do? But they're both incredible families, and they're all the families, the way they unite, it's incredible. And same thing, you know, being involved, I was involved with Sandy Hook Promise for a while, and these incredible people have had the worst thing that could possibly happen to you in life. I mean, we have no word for a parent that loses a child. I mean, if you lose your spouse, you're a widow. If you're a kid and you lose both your parents, you're an orphan. We have no word in our dictionary that describes a parent losing a child. There's a reason for that, because it's unthinkable. And so they're just so empowering. And but then again, then Dayton happens. Then Texas happens. Then we can name every city in the United States. I mean, and that is just, they get re-victimized every time. How do they deal with it? They go to the city to be with the victims. I mean, Patricia was there at Uvalde. She's been to Uvalde five times.
Well, and we've been talking about schools because that's the context. But we can only talk so much about arming the bad guys at schools. What happens when it's a synagogue in Pittsburgh? What happens when it's a church in the South? You can't arm good guys everywhere.
Yeah, and I was speaking at a security conference a couple of weeks ago in Atlanta, and a pastor asked me the question, you know, here's what I do at my church. And I'm talking about, he probably does more than the hotel does here. And he's like, what more can I do? And I said, sir, you're doing about all you can do. The problem is when there's someone out there armed with that weapon and there's somebody there angry about in the third pew, I don't know if you can stop them. And we have security books now on how to secure houses of worship. There's four different, I mean, think about that. And you're right. It's a synagogue here. It's a church here. It's a mosque here. It doesn't matter.
It's nothing to do with that. It's a FedEx facility in Georgia. So, it's a workplace.
It's a hotel in Vegas. It's a nightclub in Orlando. It's Virginia Tech. It's everywhere, and it's everybody's problem. And that's one thing I think businesses have to understand is, I don't care how small your business is, you have to do active shooter training. And I had a case where the mall didn't do active security training. My client, who was killed in this mass shooting at a hot yoga in Tallahassee, Florida, was a vice president of a sorority. Guess what she had done? Active shooting training, because the sororities required that. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of crazy that a sorority requires that, but businesses aren't. But I think businesses hopefully are getting better at that, because it's a terrible reality, but it's where we are.
Mike, I think this gave us a lot to think about, but I always like to give our guests last thoughts. So what are your last thoughts for our audience in 2 minutes or less? How do we solve this problem?
Yeah. You know, I think the one thing is we got to start looking at things through the same eyeglasses. And the one thing I would tell people, no matter what side you're on of all these different things, think about your own child. I mean, think about your own family. And it's a tough place to go, but this can happen to your child. And once it does, it's too late. Now you'll be on that team. You don't want to be on that team. You don't want to be. So look at it there. Let's have intelligent conversations through all the collaboration we can do to save our country from this, because it's an epidemic here. It isn't an epidemic anywhere else. It's not like COVID. It's a unique American problem, and we can solve problems. We're America. We can solve problems, but we have to look at it through that lens and work together.
It's a great last thought, and I think a very sage and cogent point. This is a uniquely American problem with a uniquely American attitude compounding everything. And as much as I hate to leave any of these on a negative note, I think for this one, I need to. So, Mike, I want to thank you for joining us. And for our listeners, thank you for listening to another episode. Please join us next week.
Thank you for joining us for this conversation. If you have any questions about your rights after listening to this show, please visit us at victimsofcrime.org. Our guest's information is also always available in the show notes. This podcast was created by the National Center for Victims of Crime in partnership with our center and affiliate, the National Crime Victim Bar Association. More information about both organizations is available at victimsofcrime.org and victimbar.org. Thank you, and please join us again next week.